elimination of cultural programs, the crackdown on other forms of public expression, and these are I think, you know, previews of the things that in the sort of solutionist mindset, the engineering mindset of someone like Musk, all forms of endeavor that aren't aimed at, you know, cracking this one central wicked problem, whether it's space travel or the expansion of the military budget, are forms of waste. So I think that we'll see a kind of a redirection of funding, obviously, towards hard research and the slashing of funding to things seen as superficial, forms of entitlement, forms of education and research. Those, I think, are the things that probably an austerity-minded Democrat could advocate as much as an austerity-minded Republican. And it's probably where they'll be able to create kind of alliances. I think that the attack on free speech in the course of the protests over Gaza since October 6th have given us a kind of a preview of how unwilling Democrats as well as Republicans are to actually stand up for the right of academic investigation and expression in this country. And I think that universities will really be the kind of the soft targets for many of those early cuts.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Quinn Slobodian, professor of international history at Boston University. His latest book is Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals and the Dream of a World Without Democracy. We'll link to your articles on Musk for the New Statesman. That does it for our show. We want to thank everyone.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What is this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It feels very hipster.
That's the worst thing.
Look at how humanity has used their intellect.
Self-help radio, a different theme explored with music and talk every week. Tuesdays, midnight to 3 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With the help of our community, we were able to reach our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio. If you didn't get a chance to contribute during our year-end campaign, you can still support KBOO by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give and join the team.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a 65-year-old in Louisiana is the first person to die from avian flu in the U.S.
New Multnomah County District Attorney Nathan Vasquez says the public defender shortage is actually a work stoppage.
And in international news, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will resign.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 6, 2025. I'm Kate Chase.
And I'm Mike Fdeklis. A 65-year-old in Louisiana is the first person in the U.S. to have died from the H5N1 bird flu. They were infected with a strain of the virus that's been circulating in wild birds and poultry, a different one than the one affecting dairy cattle. This person had a backyard flock of chickens and was exposed to wild birds, according to CNN. Most people have a low risk from bird flu, and the CDC says they won't increase the threat level for H5N1. They say they haven't found evidence for person-to-person transmission. People who keep chickens and other birds need to be careful, health authorities say, as do people who work on dairy and poultry farms. Some of those workers have raised concerns about not having proper warnings, safety gear, or testing for bird flu. People who've been in contact with sick or dead animals or their droppings should watch for red eyes and breathing problems for 10 days after they were exposed. As of Friday, there were 66 human cases of bird flu in the U.S.
President Biden approved federal disaster assistance funds for Oregon to help with recovery efforts in areas impacted by the 2024 wildfires. It was a record year for wildfires in the state, with 1.9 million acres burned. That's over a million more acres than the average wildfire season. Governor Tina Kotek called a special session of the legislature in December to approve over $200 million to help pay for the costs of fighting those fires. The federal major disaster declaration means that the state, local governments, and certain nonprofits will get funds to help their recovery and rebuilding. The counties Gilliam, Grant, Umatilla, Wasco, and Wheeler were the hardest hit. Kotek said, quote, "I am grateful that the federal government took action to provide relief to rural Oregon communities after this unprecedented, destructive wildfire season. This federal declaration is an important step to help us respond to the scale and persistence of wildfires this year," end quote. The intensity of recent wildfire seasons in Oregon is connected to the climate crisis. It causes things like hotter temperatures and extended droughts, which means forests become more at risk for earlier, hotter, and faster spreading wildfires.
5,000 Providence nurses and doctors plan to strike on Friday because of stalled contract negotiations. Providence Health says it will return to the table after initially refusing to negotiate during the Oregon Nurses Association's 10-day strike warning. The union cites unsafe conditions and low pay as critical issues at play. They say this Friday could begin the state's first doctors' strike. Isabel Charlet has more.
Oregon's largest healthcare strike, including the state's first doctor strike, is set to begin this Friday if a settlement cannot be reached. The Oregon Nurses Association delivered a 10-day notice of an open-ended strike to Providence Health and Services in Oregon last week, accusing it of dangerous levels of understaffing, neglecting patient care, and offering inadequate pay and benefits. Dr. Charlie Saltalamacchia is an OBGYN at Providence and says in labor and delivery, there's no cap on the number of patients, leading to unsafe conditions.
We can sometimes have patients that we're responsible for in excess of 30 during a shift, and there can be multiple emergencies happening at the same time with no limits.
Without a deal, nearly 5,000 nurses, doctors, and other providers will walk off the job at all 8 Oregon Providence hospitals and 6 clinics starting this Friday. CEO Jennifer Burrows wrote in a statement that Providence offered double-digit pay raises for nurses and accused the union of refusing to compromise. The union says they are being stonewalled. Saltalamacchia says providers often stay longer than their shifts and are asking for pay and working conditions that are comparable to other hospitals.
These healthcare workers have worked for so many years at great personal expense and cost to provide excellent patient care. And these requests are just really reasonable.
Providence is a nonprofit operating 51 hospitals in 7 states. It merged with California's St. Joseph system in 2016. Registered nurse Jay Formick says that was a turning point.
They went from being companions or partners in the process of negotiating a contract to becoming hard and fast opponents.
Providence initially refused to negotiate during the 10-day strike notice, prompting the ONA to file an unfair labor practice charge. Providence has since said in a statement it will resume talks with union doctors and urge them not to strike, citing the difficulty of replacing them compared with nurses. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Multnomah County's new district attorney, Nathan Vasquez, started on the job today after being sworn in last week. In an interview with OPB's Conrad Wilson, Vasquez called for more jail beds, and he called out the county's public defenders. Oregon has a well-documented shortage of public defenders, which means people who are accused of a crime can spend extra weeks or months in jail before they get public defender to take their case. Thousands of people have been unable to get their constitutional right to representation in court because there are too few public defenders and because of how Oregon has funded the public defender system. Vasquez doesn't see it this way. He referred to the crisis as a work stoppage. Vasquez told OPB, quote, "I see many, many defense attorneys who work extremely hard, but that's not all the public defenders. In fact, that's only a section of them here in Multnomah County," end quote. He also suggested the county spend $40 to $50 million on increasing the amount of jail beds the county has and using some specifically for people to sober up. The county is looking at budget cuts later this year. Vasquez told OPB he spent a lot of time becoming friendly with the police officers in the county and that he hopes his overall efforts as district attorney will bring the murder rate down.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will resign as leader of the ruling Liberal Party. Trudeau has been the leader of Canada's Liberal Party for 11 years and the country's prime minister for 9. He told reporters today, quote, "I intend to resign as party leader, as prime minister, after the party selects its new leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process," end quote. The resignation came as polls showed that the Liberal Party was set to be soundly defeated by the Conservative Party in the upcoming election. Though he was immensely popular when elected, with approval ratings above 60%, his government has experienced a marked drop in popularity recently. Trudeau added, quote, "It has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option. I've been inspired by the resilience, generosity, and the determination of the Canadians," end quote. He did also criticize Conservative opposition leader Pierre Poilievre's vision for Canada as not the right one for the country. The prime minister himself is unpopular among many in Canada. Canadians are very concerned with cost of living increases and immigration. They're also worried about potential upcoming tariffs under soon-to-be President Trump. Last month, multiple members of Trudeau's cabinet resigned. Trudeau was then under pressure to call for an election before the scheduled one in October. Trudeau will remain prime minister in a caretaker capacity until a new party leader is chosen. That person will become the next Canadian prime minister.
The Voice for the U.S. Virgin Islands in Congress questions American imperialism, Congress certifies the 2024 election, and Trump says he wants cabinet nominees quickly confirmed following the terrorist attack in New Orleans. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This body and this nation has a territories and a colonies problem. What was supposed to be temporary has now effectively become permanent.
Stacey Plaskett, U.S. Virgin Islands delegate in the House, says it's unjust that those representing 4 million American citizens don't have a voice in picking the speaker. To boos from Republicans, she said citizens in Guam and Puerto Rico pay taxes and serve in the military more often than any state, while their votes in federal elections are merely symbolic. Her comments come as President-elect Donald Trump says he wants the U.S. to reclaim the Panama Canal. Next on the schedule for the 119th Congress is certifying the 2024 election. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York assured Republicans there will be a peaceful transfer of power.
It's okay. There are no election deniers on our side of the aisle.
Trump has promised to pardon many January 6 rioters on day one. More than 1,200 have pleaded guilty or been convicted of crimes, including seditious conspiracy and assaulting police. California Senator Adam Schiff says pardons would encourage lawlessness.
He will begin his new administration the way he ended his last administration, and that is by celebrating violence against our democracy.
Trump will face his own criminal sentence this Friday, 10 days before taking office. But the judge in his New York hush money case says he's likely to close the felony conviction without jailing the president-elect. House Speaker Mike Johnson says Republicans will pursue an aggressive first 100 days. That includes changing the National Voter Registration Act to require proof of citizenship to vote in federal elections. Johnson says just because it's already illegal doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Just because something's on the books doesn't mean people are going to comply. You don't get to go into a liquor store or to go buy cigarettes and check a box and say, oh yeah, I'm 21. Give me the product. That's not how it works.
Meanwhile, Trump is urging the Senate to move quickly on confirming his cabinet nominees in light of last week's deadly terrorist attack in New Orleans. But new Senate Majority Leader John Thune of South Dakota says it's unclear if nominees like Kash Patel, Trump's pick to lead the FBI, can secure enough Republican votes.
We will have these hearings, allow people to ask questions, and then we will move very quickly to see that President Trump has his team in place, and especially in those key national security positions.
The Director of Intelligence nominee, former Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, also faces resistance. Critics say her ties to Russia and pro-Kremlin stances make her a national security threat. Trump's transition team has agreed to allow some FBI background checks, but it's unclear if every pick will be vetted. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. On this episode, Decoding Algorithmic Racism with Sophia Umoja Noble. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear and windy with a chilly overnight low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 49. Today in history, in 1994, figure skater Nancy Kerrigan is attacked and injured by someone hired by her rival Tanya Harding's ex-husband during the U.S. Figure Skating Championships. The quote of the day is from Bahamian-American actor Sidney Poitier, the first black actor to win an Oscar for Best Actor. He died this day in 2022. Poitier said, quote, "When you're addressing power, don't expect it to crumble willingly. If you're going to say, hey now, look guys, please look at what you did and look at yourselves and punish yourselves and at least try to square this thing, right? Well, you'll make slower progress at that than you would expect."
A new plan from the Department of Agriculture aims to boost collaboration with tribes, helping to build more sustainable food systems. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has a new plan to strengthen its collaboration with tribes and help them build more sustainable food systems. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
Nationwide, there are 574 federally recognized tribes. Nearly half of them are in the West, where tribes manage or farm more than 55 million acres of land. The USDA's new strategy aims to help tribes better protect and preserve the natural resources and farmland they rely on. That includes dedicating more staff and funding to conservation across tribal lands and incorporating indigenous knowledge into that work. Roylene Comes at Night is a conservationist with the agency and a member of the Blackfeet Nation in Montana.
This gives us an opportunity to now build this tribe by tribe, and so that each tribal nation that has their own concerns can adopt and adapt those concerns to meet their needs.
She says overall the new strategy supports tribes' cultural and farming traditions and will make sure their priorities and knowledge shape future federal policies. I'm Caleb Radel.
A new study profiles a recently discovered species of amphibian that survived harsh Wyoming weather by burrowing into the ground. It lived near the Wind River Reservation millions of years ago. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements has more.
University of Wisconsin researcher Dave Lovelace came across the fossils, still preserved in their burrows, on BLM land near Du Bois. He returned there over the years, eventually partnering with the Eastern Shoshone tribe to bring local middle school students and elders to the site. The idea was to have researchers talk about the fossils and for elders of the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes to discuss their knowledge of the creatures. Here's Lovelace.
Looking at weaving those two narratives together. We don't have that built-in knowledge and history.
Reba Turan is Eastern Shoshone and a co-author of the paper. She named the species Ninnambihan Dakutaka, two Shoshone words.
The Ninnambi are still here with us. They were very powerful beings. They were only like 3 feet tall, and they live up in our mountains even today.
Lovelace says the early amphibians' burrowing habit gives researchers hope about a way for modern amphibians to survive climate change. I'm Chris Clements in Laramie.
The Aleutic Museum in Alaska has received a grant to revamp its cultural library. As KMXT's Brian Benoit reports, it will be part of the museum's grand reopening in May.
The Aleutic Museum has been closed for over a year for an expansion project to nearly double its size. Museum officials plan to display more items from its collections as well as feature more art from contemporary culture bearers. But now with this grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Sciences, the museum will make it easier than ever to access its library, too.
In the past, we had a library. I don't think anyone knew that.
That's Amanda Lancaster, the museum's curator of collections. Since 2018, the library has served as the official tribal library of Koniag, Kodiak's regional native corporation.
It was in the basement. It was very inaccessible. You had to make an appointment. You had to have a staff member with you just because it was in the basement and, you know, sort of a more of a staff space.
The library features thousands of printed materials, hundreds of audiovisual items, and well over 10,000 photos as part of the collection for people to research Aleutic culture. The new funding will help the museum pay for renovations for a more friendly library space. Lancaster says they're aiming to have matching shelving units, furniture for a seating area, and computers for research. Patrons won't need appointments or staff supervision just to be in there. They'll just need to check in at the front desk and use the library at their leisure. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Vanois.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Privatization of the United States Postal Service could leave rural areas without mail service and hinder critical functions like receiving checks and paying taxes. Experts say lawmakers could make changes that would allow the agency to function better and adapt to the digital age. The Postal Service lost $1.8 billion in revenue last year. Nadia Ramlagan reports from Kentucky.
The Trump administration and some House Republicans, including Kentucky Representative James Comer, have floated the idea of privatizing the United States Postal Service. Experts say operating the agency like a private business could leave Kentucky's rural areas without mail options for essential functions, such as receiving checks or paying taxes. Tyler Offerman with the Kentucky Equal Justice Center says privatization would eliminate essential infrastructure in rural counties, noting 54 of the Commonwealth's 120 counties are entirely rural with no urban center.
Many parts of Kentucky are not profitable based on some of these companies' business models, and they're considered expendable.
USPS saw $1.8 billion in controllable losses in fiscal year 2024, compared to more than $2 billion the prior year, according to the agency. Supporters of privatization argue mail volume is dwindling and the agency has lost billions of dollars over the past decade. Similar to how the decline in rural Kentucky hospitals has forced people to travel farther or skip medical care, Offerman points out the state's most vulnerable people would have to travel farther for mail service or go without timely delivery and access to information they need to make ends meet.
So I help people in food stamps and WIC, and we've got people that help people with Medicaid. The way that you sign up and you get information around those programs is either the internet or the notices you get in the mail.
Porter McConnell is with Americans for Financial Reform and founder of the Save the Post Office Coalition. She says the agency was designed for the public good in a functioning democracy. She adds legislation requiring the agency to break even and poor decisions that have left it behind in the digital age need to be addressed to keep it robust.
It's a terrible candidate for privatization because it's a core service that everybody needs, and everybody needs to be able to use affordably, and the consequences would be disastrous.
An April 2024 poll by the Pew Research Center found overall 72% of Americans have a favorable view of the Postal Service. That number jumps to 76% among Democrats and dips to 68% among Republicans. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
The Idaho State Board of Education has passed a resolution to get rid of diversity and inclusion efforts in higher education institutions. But the latest effort to target DEI is receiving pushback. Eric Tegedoff has more on this story.
Despite pushback, Idaho is again targeting diversity and inclusion efforts on college campuses. Over the holiday break, the Idaho State Board of Education passed the Resolution on DEI Ideology in Higher Education, which prevents central offices, policies, procedures, or initiatives on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Francisco Salinas currently works at Spokane Falls Community College, but has worked at the University of Idaho and Boise State University, including as Director of Student Diversity and Inclusion. He says he worked with students and student groups that welcomed and supported peers with similar backgrounds and experiences.
I got to see it be transformational in the lives of students, and it was heartwarming, and that's why it's so heartbreaking to see these things taken away.
The board says DEI efforts in higher education are not welcoming for every student, but the board also acknowledged at the December 18th meeting where the resolution passed that it received feedback from nearly 700 students, about 80% of whom were against the resolution. Many Idaho universities have already closed or renamed offices and positions associated with diversity and inclusion, including Salinas, who had his job title changed to Assistant to the Vice President for Equity Initiatives at Boise State University before he left in 2022. He says students and staff are likely to reconsider coming to or staying in Idaho.
This kind of thing makes it less likely that the state of Idaho not only will see a diverse population of students in higher education, but it's a real signal for faculty that might consider employment in the state of Idaho, that the state of Idaho is actually hostile to diversity efforts.
Higher education institutions are required to comply with the resolution by June 30th, but Salinas hopes students in particular feel this is an ongoing discussion.
Because there was a decision made does not mean that the conversation is over. And that's the way that power works. It's an ongoing negotiation, but they need to know that they have a place in that negotiation.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Saying that people are spending too much time on their smartphones is nothing new. But those in the academic world are increasingly gathering information about the negative effects. While it might be difficult, they say there are ways to make digital-free habits hold. Mike Moen reports.
If reducing screen time is your New Year's resolution, a Minnesota expert says it can be tough. But with increasing concerns about the effects of too much media consumption, learning how to limit access is the best place to start. The overlap between doom scrolling and the recent election might have prompted some people to reevaluate their screen time. And it isn't just posts about politics that have the academic world worried. University of Minnesota Duluth communications professor Aaron Boyson teaches about media addiction. He says electronic devices, streaming platforms, and other digital tools are heavily woven into everyday life.
I hear a lot from students, especially these days, about fatigue and overuse and tiredness and frustration and irritability and all those things.
Boyson's students are challenged to go a couple of weeks media-free. He reports a 3-to-1 ratio of positive effects over negative feelings, but says most go back to normal usage. Boyson says for anyone, building shields, such as a room in your home free of devices and used only for non-screen activities, can help chip away at bad habits. But he warns it could take several weeks for your brain to get used to it. Boyson says one positive aspect of successfully detaching yourself from your smartphone prison is improved communication skills. He adds if part of your plan is to take more walks, it's best to leave the headphones and podcasts at home.
It's really, really important that there are non-mediated times where the mind just is free to think. That is what some cognitive psychologists call the default mode network, when your brain isn't being stimulated by some external source.
He says for younger generations born into a tech-driven world, it's much harder to experience life that way, which potentially affects their emotional development. As for concerns from parents, research has shown their screen time usage is on par with their kids. Boyson says they'll have to confront their own denial and join the whole family in curtailing access. This is Mike Bowen for Minnesota News Connection.
January is the coldest month in most states across the country. Cold weather can pose risks for individuals with heart conditions, but the American Heart Association offers helpful tips to maintain heart health during this chilly season. Crystal Blair has the details.
The American Heart Association has tips on staying heart healthy in winter, including dressing warmly to reduce strain on your heart and avoiding overexertion during activities like shoveling snow. Dr. Ravi Johar is a board member of the American Heart Association. He says snow shoveling is a leading cause of winter heart problems, especially for men in their 50s and 60s. He stresses cold weather constricts blood vessels, increasing the heart's demand for more blood during exertion.
So you have a combination of the body needing more blood to the heart and getting less flow through it because of the cold weather. And that unfortunately can lead to a heart attack. And it's one of the most common times that you do see a heart attack occurring is at that time of year.
Other winter tips from the American Heart Association include eating balanced meals with fruits, vegetables, lean proteins, and whole grains, and limiting alcohol because it can make you feel warmer than you are, raising the risk of hypothermia. While it may be very comforting to enjoy a hot cup of cocoa or apple cider in the winter, heart health experts warn these drinks are often loaded with sugar, which can be dangerous for the heart if you drink too much. Dr. Johar adds exercising in in winter can be very beneficial.
Exercise at any time of the year will increase your immunity. And so during cold and flu season, having a little bit better immunity is always beneficial. You do need to make sure you have enough fluids. You need to stay hydrated. Even though you don't feel quite as thirsty because you're not sweating as much, it's really important to make sure you stay hydrated.
The American Heart Association emphasizes that people should pay attention to symptoms like chest discomfort, dizziness, or unusual fatigue, and seek medical help if needed. For the Missouri News Service, I'm Crystal Blee.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 6th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineers are Althea Billings and Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Crystal Blair, Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Charlet, Antonio Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Catherine Carley, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Mike Fdaklis.
And I'm Kate Chase. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact.